You're listening to the Ref Recap Podcast on 960theref.com. Here are your hosts, Sam Franco and Ryan Goldstein.
All right, welcome into another exciting edition of the Ref Recap Podcast right here on 960theref.com, although this one might not be as exciting as some of the other ones. Sam Franco and Ryan Goldstein along with you. Thank you so much for joining us. You can find us every week at 960theref.com, also facebook.com/960theref, and on Twitter at 960theref. And Ryan, this week, unfortunately, we are talking about the most epic collapse in Super Bowl history. The Atlanta Falcons had a 25-point lead on the New England Patriots and could not hold that lead as they fall to New England and really just have one of the worst performances in a championship game ever in any sport. And it's obviously something that if you're a Falcons fan, you're going to have to deal with for a long time now. And as Falcons fans, this one's going to hurt for a long time.
Yeah, there's probably, you know, 2012 when the Dogs lost in the SEC championship game to Alabama, I thought that was kind of as bad as it could get. And then the Falcons got to the Super Bowl, and I just, you never anticipated the game going like it did. And then when they were up 28-3, you just felt like you were planning for the parade. And I was about to start texting friends, you know, where are we going to go out tonight? And what is the plan for after the game? And I stopped myself, and I was like, well, maybe I'll just wait. And then slowly but surely, it's like watching a roller coaster that you know is about to crash, but you can't tell the person who's running it to stop it. And that's how watching that game was at the end. It was this series of unfortunate events that just continued to happen time after time. And you kind of was like, is this real? Is this actually happening right now?
Yeah, it was awful. Did you have a specific moment that you thought, all right, this is going badly? I'll say mine first. It was when Devontae whiffed on the block and they recovered the ball there in very good field position. They obviously ended up scoring a touchdown. When that happened, it started to hit me like, this is going really poorly, and I think Atlanta has a very good chance to lose this game.
For me, it was probably a little bit later because I still had hope, and I was like, okay, we can finish this off. To me, it was the series when obviously Julio Jones gets the catch, and then we get backed up, and we end up getting out of field goal range. To me, that was kind of the moment where it was like, okay, we can't even finish off this field goal. Because at that point, you had been up 11 points with 3 minutes left or 4 minutes left in the game, and you feel really good about your chances because they'll have to give you the ball back. They'll probably have to use timeouts. That, to me, was kind of the moment when I was just like, okay, so we don't get any points here, and now they're down by 8, and they're going to have the ball and drive down the field. And then, obviously, when they got the coin toss in overtime, I was like, well, that's probably it.
Yeah, and getting to the one you were talking about there, obviously it was awful to see the fact that after running the ball, after Julio's just otherworldly catch, and after running the ball on first down and losing a yard, it's almost like Kyle Shanahan completely panicked and tries to throw the ball there. It's like, dude, you do not need a touchdown. You need a field goal, and the game is over. And they try to throw the ball, and unfortunately, you get knocked back, and Jake Matthews, who had a pretty awful game, ends up with a holding call that pushes you back even further. And I think I saw some sort of stat where it had, like, never happened before in a situation where a team had like first and 10 and like at the 22 and ended up having to punt from it, or, you know, I don't know if never.
Yeah, but I think it was 108 situations this year happened like that.
Right.
And they were the only team that punted it, you know, like 75 or 80% of them ended up in a touchdown or a field goal, and then the other 15 or 20 maybe ended up in a turnover. But yeah, nobody had punted when they started up right there. It was just, and the thing that I think upsets me the most about the way this all went down is just the image of Atlanta sports and how we're always waiting for the other shoe to drop, and you just felt like this was different. And being up 28-3, you're almost thinking, well, we just beat one of the greatest dynasties, you know, the greatest team, and we beat them to a pulp, right? I mean, you're up 28-3, and you think, you know, maybe we'll get another touchdown. Maybe they'll come back and score, but the final score maybe be like 35-17. You know, we're gonna kill this team. And we're going to go on to hold the Lombardi Trophy and have a parade on Tuesday in Atlanta, and it all just disappeared.
It really
kind of
did.
Like out of thin air. You know, it was like you were sinking in quicksand, And little by little, you were just getting further and further down, and you couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, and it's funny. I believe I heard Chris Brain mention this on the home team, where he was like, Atlanta should have just hit an onside kick to start the overtime, because there was no way they were going to stop New England. And as soon as New England won the coin toss, I knew the game was over. I mean, there was no way. The momentum had completely shifted into New England's favor. Atlanta's defense was just dog tired from being on the field for so long. I mean, Tom Brady threw 62 passes. Matt Ryan only threw 23. I mean, it was a just astronomical difference in time of possession, 17 minutes. And Atlanta just left the defense out to dry there. The offense with the schizophrenic play calling of Kyle Shanahan in the second half, where he was way too conservative when he should have been aggressive earlier on in the second half, and then he was way too aggressive when he should have been conservative there after Julio made that catch. So Kyle Shanahan admitted it, you know, after the game. I believe people around the team hotel, like sources said, that he was telling people that he blew it, and he did. He completely blew the pooch on this one, and unfortunately or screwed the pooch, I guess, is the quote or the saying there. But regardless of whatever it is, he screwed up bad. And a lot of Falcons fans, as he now leaves to take that job in San Francisco, the head coaching job there, are like, you know, don't let the door hit you on the way out. But you hung the defense out to dry.
Yeah, but the thing is, I don't, you know, look, he screwed up in the biggest game of his life. And there's no denying that, and questionable play calling without a doubt. But there's a reason why we were in this position to begin with.
Oh, of course.
He's a big part of that. So the fans and the people out there that all want to just, you know, oh, Kyle Shanahan, you can leave, whatever. Look, this guy did a lot of great things. I mean, that's the thing that's you kind of forget about. And I heard someone talk about this. They were like, you know, watching your sports team is like being in a relationship. You know, there's always going to be highs and lows, so you can't necessarily just judge it based off the end. You know, like if you break up with a girl and all of a sudden the ending sucks, but it's like you might have had a great relationship with her the whole, you know, for years. But all of a sudden, you're just going to remember the last thing you happened. You kind of have to think back through the whole thing. It doesn't make it any easier that we lost this game. And look, until the Falcons win another Super Bowl, well, until they win a Super Bowl, not another Super Bowl, they never won one. But until they win a Super Bowl, this game will always be cemented as, you know, the one thing you associate with the Falcons. And that's the most unfortunate part about it, because for a team that had such a great season to end the way they did, it just sucks.
Yeah, the team deserves better than that, and I mean, you can throw blame around, you know, you can say Matt Ryan shouldn't hold the ball as long, and I think when you had an offensive line that was playing as well as they did throughout the course of the season, then your quarterback might be, I don't know, a little more conditioned to hold the ball longer because he's had that time, and Matt Ryan didn't have that time against New England. That defensive front played really well, and unfortunately, you can throw some blame around as well to Dan Quinn, just in terms of the management of the clock and the time there. And challenging the Edelman catch was just dumb because that wasted one of your timeouts. I will say that, and I don't know where this would fall on, but the fact that the Falcons had to burn a timeout because Matt Ryan's helmet audio
right.
or the radio
right.
wouldn't work. Why should the Falcons have to burn a timeout there? That shouldn't be on the Falcons. That should be like an official timeout to get that fixed.
I'm with you there because, yeah, that ends up burning them. And like you said, the Edelman catch, and then they're, you know, because I guess they ended up getting the ball back with just under a minute. I think it was 56 seconds is what they had.
But no timeouts. Left.
Exactly, with no timeouts, right? So if you have two timeouts in your pocket, you know, you could do something there if you end up getting a completion on first down. Look, the game was just terrible. You know, it's just there's really no other way to describe it. And I think the thing that makes me just the most upset is that for years and years and years to come, every Super Bowl or every championship will always be – there will always be some association or some reference made to this game and how the Falcons were the only team to ever give up a lead of larger than 10 points. And it'll be like if a team comes from behind, the other team who had the lead will be Falconing. You know, I mean, that's going to be a thing. And that's just –
until the Falcons win a Super Bowl, which we don't know when that'll be, if ever.
Right, right. So – look, but at the same time, this team gave us a lot more than we ever expected. And again, it doesn't make what happened on Sunday any better. But to think that they were even in this position in the first place is pretty cool.
And that's where we'll put this game to bed and move on to the off season and what will happen now. And the first big domino to fall is Kyle Shanahan leaving, and the Falcons replaced him with Steve Sarkisian. What? Like, that came completely out of left field. But I love the hire for multiple reasons. I think he's a guy who still has a lot to prove. I also think he's a very good offensive mind. He knows the West Coast system, which is kind of what Atlanta's been running. He's not going to change up too much from what Kyle Shanahan was doing. And, again, you don't want to mess with success, and the Falcons had the highest scoring offense in the NFL, so why would you bring in a guy that's going to change the system?
No, everything that I've read so far about it, and again, you know, it's not like you or I know him personally, but the things you read about him from people who know the business, it seems to be a good hire, with the exception of the fact that unless he falls off the wagon and, you know, gets back into his drinking, you know, if that becomes an issue, that would be the only issue I see with the hire right now. But you're right. I mean, the continuity will be there. And obviously one of my friends said, well, it's not going to be apples to apples. Well, no change is going to be apples to apples, but I think it's a lot closer to apples to apples than if you brought in a Chip Kelly, and then it's like apples to oranges, the offensive system. Because people forget that Matt Ryan's had a lot of different offensive coordinators, and while hopefully personnel will still be intact next year, you have to think if you're opening or learning a new playbook with new terminology, that takes some time to adjust. So hopefully Sark, and which I think they're trying to do, will keep the language the same going forward. And like you said, he has a lot to prove. Somebody who was out of football for a little while, and the funny thing about that was the first team he visited while out of football, you know, a lot of these coaches will go visit other teams while they're out of football to get, you know, just to learn from other people, see what other teams are doing. The first stop was the Falcons. And then there's the obvious Pete Carroll connection that Dan Quinn and both Steve Sarkisian share. Sark worked for Pete Carroll at USC, and then Dan Quinn obviously worked for Pete Carroll with Seattle. So it seems like that was a big sticking point, that Carroll was one who went to bat for Sarkisian and said, look, this is a guy who you should hire.
Absolutely, and I think that it's going to be a good transition for Atlanta just because you're going to have a guy that runs a similar offense. And I also think that while Kyle Shanahan might have been a little stubborn at times, I think Sarkisian probably listens to Matt Ryan a little more, and maybe Matt Ryan even has a little more autonomy in running this offense. And maybe we see the no huddle come back a little bit more, because that was something that Ryan has always been very comfortable running and looked very good while doing it. And maybe he's able to do that some more with a little more influence on what the offense is.
Yeah, no, I think it seems to be a good match. And I think, going back to what you said about proving himself, I think that's huge. Because you feel like this is a guy who, look, he was the Oakland Raiders quarterback coach in the early 2000s. And an article I read was that Al Davis really wanted him to be the head coach when Lane Kiffin ended up getting the job many, many years ago. So, I mean, it seems like this guy, obviously the football mind he has is something that people around the league recognize. It was just maybe some of the off-the-field issues. And then he obviously went back to the college game. So he's definitely capable of doing this. And it seems like this is a great stepping stone, this Falcons offensive coordinator job, because the last four that they've had, Dirk Cutter, Mike Mularkey, Hugh Jackson for the one season under Bob Petrino, and now Kyle Shanahan, have all gone on to become head coaches. So you have this guy in Steve Sarkisian who wants to resurrect his career, and this seems like no better place to do it with an MVP performer in Matt Ryan and then so many offensive weapons. You feel like you kind of have a cupboard stacked and you can do what you want with it.
And the Falcons also cleaned a little bit of house on the defensive side of the ball, where Richard Smith, the defensive coordinator, will not be retained in that role, nor will Brian Cox, the defensive line coach. So Atlanta going to go in some different directions there. And that really brings up the question, how much of this is kind of blame being put, or maybe is this Arthur Blank kind of coming down and saying, hey, some heads have to roll for what just happened. And Dan Quinn has reportedly been calling the plays on defense for like the second half of the season, and the defense got better in the second half of the season. So what does that tell you? That maybe Quinn should not have yielded play calling on defense in the first place, and that we'll see some new coaches come in here and try and shore things up a little bit.
Yeah, and I think it's probably more – I don't think the way the Super Bowl ended is the reason why these guys are gone. You have to believe that these decisions were probably – coming anyways, especially if, like you said, if Dan Quinn was already calling the plays on defense. And it seems like Richard Smith could be back with the Falcons in kind of an advisory role. And as for Brian Cox, you know, you don't know what the deal is there, but maybe they're just looking for someone else, a little bit of a new voice to take over there. Because you would think that the defense was not the reason why we lost the Super Bowl. I mean, we went over the time possession was just heavily favored the Patriots. And after a certain amount of time, you can't be expected to continue a pass rush when you've been on the field, you know, 15 or 20 minutes longer than you should be.
Exactly. So just a bad taste in your mouth there with all that going on. And unfortunately, the defense sees a lot of the blame, even though they probably don't deserve it, because, again, they were just on the field way too much and Tom Brady, with the way that the Patriots offense runs kind of shortly or short gains down the field, they're not going to go for really anything longer than 20 yards. So that dink and dunk keeps you on the field for a long time. And then, yeah, the defense just gets tired. So that's kind of what happened there. And looking at kind of what the Falcons can do now that we've talked about the coaches a little bit there, obviously they need to add some help in the linebacking core. Getting Desmond Trufant back will definitely help the secondary out. And there's going to be guys to go get. You know, what if an Eric Berry is a possibility, or a Dante Hightower, who Falcons fans know really well from the Super Bowl. He's a guy that's going to be an unrestricted free agent, and the Patriots have shown in the past that they aren't necessarily willing to outbid teams for players. So could Hightower be a guy that hits the market? And if he is, Atlanta, I think, would be nuts not to make a run at him.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, you want to just get faster on defense, and I think adding another edge rusher, you know, Dwight Freeney, whether he comes back or not for another season with the Falcons, or whether he comes back in the NFL or not, still remains to be seen. But the pass rush is still an area in the front four where you got to get better. You lost a guy like Derek Shelby and Adrian Claiborne. Those guys were both out due to injuries in the playoffs, but you feel like, you know, you get, maybe you draft a Carl Lawson from Auburn, or a
Derek Barnett. Harris.
Yeah, or Derek Barnett or Charles Harris from Missouri. You feel like the pass rush still needs to be an area of concern, or an area where you feel like you can get better, because Vic Beasley clearly showed what he can do, but it seems like in the NFL, and it showed this year, I mean, the speed that the Falcons covet is something that is huge. Deion Jones, phenomenal rookie, with, you know, him flying all over the field, he did it again in the Super Bowl, so getting faster on defense will continue to be an area of concern. And then I would assume guard, Chris Chester might be on his way out with Kyle Shanahan leaving, because he was a guy that had come with Kyle Shanahan, I believe. So maybe you shore up the guard position. But at least you like the idea of the Falcons drafting later and in free agency being able to add players. And now with the Falcons being a team that just had a Super Bowl appearance, you feel like players will want to come to Atlanta and be a part of the culture that Dan Quinn has put together here.
So what do the Falcons, do you think, have to do to kind of fight off this Super Bowl hangover? Because we've seen teams that lost the Super Bowl come back the next season and not have very good seasons. So I think this team's a little different because they're very young on the defensive side of the ball. They've got very good pieces on the offensive side of the ball. And it just doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot different. I know that their schedule does probably get a little tougher, even though based on opponent win-loss record, they had the toughest schedule in the NFL this season, and we thought that was going to be the case going into the season, but after the season it was proven to be that too. But it looks like this team's probably going to be opening at New England on that Thursday night game, just because they can have a Super Bowl rematch, and they've shown that they like to do that if they can. So that's one that, you know, you have to worry about opening the season there with all the fanfare that'll be surrounding that, with the Patriots getting another Lombardi trophy, and that's just going to put a terrible taste in all of our mouths to start the season like that. But if that is indeed the case, but I think that Atlanta just has to, you know, keep, this is going to sound so Dan Quinn, but keep trusting in what they're doing and keep to the plan, because that's what got them where they were this year in the first place.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think the second you kind of divert from that, because you're right, I mean, there's a reason why they were in the position they were in to begin with, and it seems like they really do believe in this brotherhood. As cheesy as it sounds for us to talk about, you kind of feel it when the players talk about it and the coaches talk about it. And it's also probably adding key pieces like a Dwight Freeney. You know, do you bring in a veteran who's looking to make one last run in the Super Bowl and, you know, mix that with some young players that you draft? You want guys that are hungry to be there again. And sometimes it's like when you get a taste of something, you want it even more. And hopefully you can add players, add a couple pieces of, you know, maybe it's a fourth or fifth year veteran who's just kind of bounced around, but Dan Quinn finds a knack for them in his defense. Or you get a wide receiver who's kind of been brushed aside, but then Matt Ryan finds a way to incorporate them into the offense. Players who are hungry, and I'm sure when you see a team in the Super Bowl, you go, I want to be a part of that culture. And so adding just a couple different pieces and bringing back the core of what you have this year, and it seems like you'd be poised to make a pretty good run next season.
Absolutely. We'll jump to some UGA news and notes now. We'll start with the news on the UGA defensive coaching staff, where Tracy Rocker will not be back. Still kind of cloudy as to why exactly he's not going to be back with Georgia, but a lot of people think that he's one of the better coaches on Georgia's team, and this could be one that's just kind of a little bit of a head scratcher.
Yeah, to me it was surprising. He seemed to be, especially because he was a holdover from Mark Richt's staff. Typically, at least the way I would think about it is, if you have a holdover, it's somebody that you clearly think is capable of doing the job because you felt like, you know, even if they were associated with the last staff, you wanted them to be a part of what you were doing. And it would make sense that there was a coach that maybe didn't make it to year two under Kirby Smart, because you kind of feel like the first time a coach will assemble a staff, there'd be different pieces that maybe don't fit. And you realize after 1 year, maybe this just isn't the right fit. The rocker probably wasn't the guy I would have assumed, especially with the play of Trent Thompson, Julian Rochester. And some people will point to the fact that they missed out on five-star recruit last year, Derek Brown, who went to Auburn, obviously. And then you had this year, Aubrey Solomon, who went to Michigan. Some people will point to that as being the reason. Maybe he's out. And that's, again, speculation. Like you said, the situation is pretty cloudy as it stands right now.
Absolutely. And I just think that sometimes we see not necessarily blame get thrown around, but we see certain things happen. And maybe with recruiting and Georgia not being able to get some of those high-profile recruits there on signing day, that guys that might have flipped or guys that Georgia couldn't flip to them, some of that has something to do with it. I don't know. That's just speculation more than anything. But the fact that Georgia finished with a top three class is great, but you just look at what Ohio State and Alabama were able to do in terms of just the sheer numbers of five-star recruits they were getting, and you want to compete with those guys. And unfortunately, Georgia is the best of the rest, kind of. If you look at Alabama, Ohio State 1-2, and then Georgia coming in at 3, yeah, they're the best of the rest, but Ohio State and Alabama clearly distanced themselves this season in recruiting.
Right, and like you said, Georgia had a great class, and so the rocker situation, really don't know, but we didn't talk about this really, I guess, much last week because we were recording it during signing day, but at least you feel good about, after a year where they struggled on the field going 8-5, Kirby Smart really was a man on a mission trying to get the best talent in Georgia. And again, you're not going to get every player. You know, the Aubrey Solomons will leave and some people just want to go play elsewhere, but you feel really good about where the direction of this team is in regards to recruiting, and you feel like they're getting better players, and the best players in the state want to come and play for Georgia, where it's not maybe in years past it was, well, I probably have more options and I could go somewhere else. Now you feel like there's something special going on in Athens where people want to be a part of it.
Exactly. So signing day was a very good day for Georgia, and this is what you talk about with recruiting, though. You can't just have one, and you got to stack them. You got to stack these classes, and hopefully Kirby Smart and company, this is just the beginning for them in that regard, because if you want to compete with the best, you know, you've got to do it on the field and off the field in recruiting. And that's something that Kirby Smart knows. He doesn't need me or anybody to tell him that. But it's one thing to know how to do it, or one thing to know it, and then it's one thing to do it. So
sure, without a doubt.
Yeah, we'll see what ends up happening there. Before we get out of here, I wanted to talk a little Georgia basketball as the Dogs fall to Florida at the Stegman Coliseum on Tuesday night. And it was a very spirited effort from Georgia. Don't get me wrong. I mean, they fought pretty hard, but unfortunately, it just seems night in and night out for this team. It's two guys, and you're really just waiting for someone else to step up besides J.J. Frazier and Yante Maton.
Now, let me ask you this. As someone who does the PA announcing for the team and is there and is courtside, I mean, do you feel like it's an effort thing? Is there a disconnect between what Coach Fox is saying and what the players are doing? I know after last night's game, he mentioned, you know, we might have to go back to a style of play where it's a little bit slower and he's calling plays from the sideline because either, you know, whether it's J.J. Frazier, whoever the point guard is, hasn't taken the reins when they're on the floor. I mean, what do you think it is as someone who sees this team pretty often?
You know, I think that it's just the lack of talent development of that third guy and maybe even in the backcourt as well, just because J.J. Frazier, you've got him, but Turtle Jackson, you know, has he gotten any better? You know, Harris and Crump, the two freshmen, it seemed like Harris was getting a lot of playing time, and Crump actually against Florida got 10 minutes, which is the most we've seen from him in a while. But my issue with Harris is, well, it's kind of like if you could mold Harris and Crump into one player, it'd be great, because Harris seems too hesitant at times to shoot, whereas Crump does not seem hesitant at all to shoot. So it's about kind of having that control and knowing when to do certain things. And unfortunately, I'm not sure Coach Fox even knows at what time certain players should be going into these games. And it's just because that's not a knock on Coach Fox. That's just the unpredictability of this young team.
Well, yeah, and a lot of it is just trying to find good lineups that work well together. And I guess it's kind of like what we thought coming into the season would be Georgia's biggest strength would be their depth, might have turned out to be a weakness in the sense that maybe you have a lot of players that can play, but you can't find the right combination of when guys should be playing with who. And that's something that's difficult because you might have 8 or 9 guys who you feel really good about, but if you can't find the right lineup to put them in, then that becomes an issue. And like you said, the emergence of the third scorer was the biggest question coming into the season. Was it going to be a freshman? Was it going to be Jawan Parker? Was it going to be, you know, Derek Ogbede? You know, to me, Derek Ogbede is someone who's a great role player, you know, could get you 8 points and 9 and 12 rebounds, and that would be awesome. You know, was Mike Edwards going to be someone to step up? Probably not, but you didn't know where it was going to come from. And like you said, at this point in the season, you still haven't seen that person emerge. And that's the scariest part because you can't rely on two players to do everything for you. And look, the other thing is last year you had Kenny Gaines and Charles Mann to alleviate some of the pressure from J.J. Frazier, allowing him to maybe get shots and not being, you know, the target of the other team on defense. Now, when you know he's the best guard on the team, it's like, okay, we're going to shift every perimeter defender to him, and if he gets around the screen, step up. Whereas last year, you had other players that you had to watch out for, so J.J. Frazier had a little bit of an easier time getting shots up on offense.
Absolutely. So with Georgia, it's just one of these things where has this team plateaued in the current situation? And, you know, that's something for people way above my pay grade to figure out. So hopefully Georgia can finish his season strong, and that would start this Saturday when they take on Tennessee on the road, and hopefully they can go out there and get a win. Well, that'll wrap up this edition of the podcast. It might be a tiny bit shorter than some of the other podcasts, but that's just because this is depressing, man. We got to cut this off. We got to stop. And we've got to hope that things go in a different direction in the state of Georgia in general, because as fans of the teams in the state, it's obviously a pretty depressing time. But Ryan, we'll leave it with you. Any final notes from you on this edition of the Ref Recap Podcast?
No, it was a fun football season. You know, one that there'll definitely be moments we want to forget, but there were definitely some fun times we had. Oh yeah, I don't know. Usually I'm a little bit more positive, but this week, like you said, I'm going through the stages of grieving right now. I think I'm like at anger today.
Yeah, you're not the only one. Today. You are not the only one.
So, but enjoy it. Everybody be good. And we'll be back. That's the thing. We'll be back. You remember that.
Yeah, you're pulling the old Jeff Dancer there. The sun will rise again.
Yes. Yes, it will.
All right, that'll wrap things up for us here on the Ref Recap Podcast right here on 960theref.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully next week and in the coming weeks, our subject matter will be a little more lively, as this loss by the Atlanta Falcons has everybody reeling a little bit. But you can always find us right here on 960theref.com and also facebook.com/960theref and on Twitter at 960theref. On Twitter, I'm at Sam J. Franco. He's at The Real Rye Guy 19. So plenty of different ways to find us. Don't forget to listen to The Morning Show every Monday through Friday, 6 to 10 a.m. Also The Home Team on Monday through Fridays from 4 to 7 p.m. Dog Nation Daily, noon to 1. So we've got you covered. You're on 960 The Ref, and we'll be back next week with another exciting episode of the Ref Recap Podcast.